Hello, everybody. Welcome back.
This is session 3. I'm Mary, and I'm an alcoholic.
And my name is Dick, and I'm an alcoholic. So we'll start with the set-aside prayer, as usual.
God,
please let me set aside everything I think I know about sobriety, life, and you, so that I may be open to a new experience. Amen. So, we're going to read chapter 2, There is a Solution, and we're going to learn about the solution to this seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. We're going to learn who gave us this information. We're going to learn where we find the clear-cut directions for taking the actions that we must take to be assured that we will join the first 100 as recovered alcoholics. We're also going to learn the difference between the fellowship and the program, and that we will learn that although we share a common problem, that in itself will not produce a solution. So we'll start on page 17, chapter 2, There is a Solution. This is the second time that we've had a paragraph start with the word we.
A chapter.
Thank you. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. So in case we don't know what they mean by recovered, it means that they've solved the drink problem. We're average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are people who would normally not mix. But there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like passengers of a great liner the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. So that's a reference to, this is the way they traveled. If you went from America to Europe in those days, you took a ship. Airplanes couldn't fly over the ocean at this time. And it's a reference to how they traveled. If you saw the movie Titanic some years ago, you remember that the female lead of the movie was in first class. She was on the upper decks. And when they had dinner, she sat at the captain's table. And the male lead of the story stayed down in the bowels of the ship. He was down in steerage. It's called steerage because in those days there were cables that ran from the wheel and the wheelhouse down to the rudder. And it's where the cables ran. So it was called steerage. And if you remember, they were very separated until they were on the lifeboats together. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in the common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us, but that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. So they're telling us that the fellowship is not enough.
So if you remember the people escaping to the lifeboats and how that bound them together, but once they were all safe, they went their separate way. What we have here in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is not only a common peril or problem, but a common solution. And that common solution keeps us together.
And the common solution, of course, is the 12 steps. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out upon which we can absolutely agree. So all 100 absolutely agreed on everything that's in this book, and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious thinking.
No.
No, it's action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism.
And again, we're talking a little bit about the singleness of purpose. We have over 200 different fellowships in the world, each one treating a different peril. In AA, we do one thing well, and that's work with alcoholics to help them recover.
An illness of this sort, and we have come to believe it an illness, involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him. No one's angry or hurt, but not so with the alcoholic illness, for with it there goes annihilation.
Annihilation means destruction.
Of all things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list.
We hope that this volume will inform and comfort those who are or may be affected. There are many. Highly competent psychiatrists who have dealt with us have found it sometimes impossible to persuade an alcoholic to discuss his situation without reserve. Strangely enough, wives, parents, and intimate friends usually find us even more unapproachable than do the psychiatrist and the doctor.
But the ex-problem drinker, who has found this solution, who is properly armed with the facts about himself, that means they've done a fourth step, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. That the man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty, meaning we're both alcoholics, that he obviously knows what he is talking about, and that his whole deportment
or behavior
shouts at the new prospect that he's a man with a real answer, that he has no holier attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except the sincere desire to be helpful. There are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions that we have found most effective. So that's testimony on the part of the first 100. They found that to be most effective.
And this is the same attitude that Ebby had when he approached Bill.
After such an approach, many take up their beds and walk again.
That's a biblical reference.
None of us makes a sole vocation of this work.
I believe we talked about the word vocation being from the Latin, to be called. So if you are called to something, this is your paid work. And we'll learn later that avocation is a subordinate occupation. It is not your paid work.
None of us makes a sole vocation of this work, nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. We feel that the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. Well, that's different than what I hear from a lot of people new in sobriety. In AA, they'll say, well, I'm not drinking today. I'm a success, according to the authors of this book. It's just a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. All of us spend much of our spare time in the sort of effort we're going to describe. That's 12-step effort, and all of them did it. All. A few are fortunate enough to be so situated that they can give nearly all their time to this work. They were unemployed.
If we keep on the way we are going, there's little doubt that much good will result, but the surface of the problem would hardly be scratched. Those of us who live in large cities are overcome by the reflection that close by, hundreds are dropping into oblivion every day. Many could recover if they had the opportunity we have enjoyed. How then shall we present that which has been so freely given us? We have concluded to publish an anonymous volume, setting forth the problem as we see it. We shall bring to the task our combined experience and knowledge. This should suggest a useful program for anyone concerned with a drinking problem.
So they remind us again that all 100 people wrote this book, not one individual. We shall bring to it our combined experience and knowledge.
Of necessity, there will have to be discussion of matters medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. We are aware that these matters are, from their very nature, controversial. Nothing would please us so much as to write a book which would contain no basis for contention or argument. So what they're saying is contention is debate or contest. They'd really like to just send this book out into the world and have it be accepted without any argument. We shall do our utmost to achieve that ideal. Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. You may have already asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why. In the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. Now remember, Dr. Silkworth is the one that told us about our condition, and we had the hopeless condition of mind and body, the twofold nature of our illness. If you are an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do?
Not what do I have to think, but what do I have to do?
It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically.
So they're going to tell us not what they think, but they're going to tell us what they did. And our instructions for the steps are written as instructions of things to do.
We should tell you what we have done. Before going into a detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. How many times have people said to us, "I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine? Lay off the hard stuff. His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl. I should think he'd stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him, but there he is, all lit up again." Now, these are commonplace observations on drinkers, which we hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours.
So they don't have the same experience with alcohol that I do. That my reaction as an alcoholic to alcohol is very different than a non-alcoholic, and they cannot understand why mine is different.
So now they're going to tell us about three types of drinkers. Type one, moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. Then, type two, we have the certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. Here's the third type. What about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink.
Here's the fellow who's been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, that's a reference to a book by Robert Louis Stevenson that was published in 1886, which is still in print, by the way, in which the two main characters have two distinct personalities.
The same person, isn't it?
Two distinct character, distinct personalities, same person. And actually, a lot of people think this may be a veiled autobiography of Robert Louis Stevenson because he died of alcoholism. He's seldom mildly intoxicated. He's more or less insanely drunk. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, but let him drink for a day and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. He is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor, but in that respect, he's incredibly dishonest and selfish. He often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes and has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then he pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. He's the fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the night around, yet early next morning, he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over the house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the wastepipe or drain. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedatives and liquor to quiet his nerves so that he can go to work. Then comes the day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative with which to taper off. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and sanitariums.
Interesting. They've given us a description or a definition of the alcoholic. They did not reference how often they drank. They only told us what happens. This is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as our behavior patterns vary. But this description should identify him roughly. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle or ruin, with all its attendant suffering and humiliation, why is it he takes that one drink? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? Perhaps there will never be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why, once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle.
We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We're equally positive that once he takes any alcohol whatever into his system, something happens, both bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. So they're telling us again, any alcohol. So we talked a lot about that in the doctor's opinion. We have to be careful of what we consume. There's alcohol in lots of foods and things like that that aren't labeled necessarily. We need to be careful. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body.
Oh.
So if we didn't take the first drink, we wouldn't have a problem. We suffer from an obsession, and once again, an obsession is an idea which cannot be overcome by another idea. Once we give into that, we have the physical allergy take place. So this is a paradigm shift. This is a shift in the way the book is going to talk. We're going to cease talking about the physical allergy, and we're going to move on to the mental obsession at this point.
So we've had 8 pages up till now talking about the physical aspect, and as Dick said, now we're going to move on to the obsession of the mind.
If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of a man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious
or false
reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he'll laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. That was my reaction most of the time. Once in a while, he may tell the truth, and the truth, strange to say, is that he usually has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses with which they're satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts, they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady...
Malady is just another term for sickness or illness.
...has a real hold, they're a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they'll beat the game.
But and this is our insanity as it relates to alcohol, and we're going to be addressing that more in the second step.
But they often suspect they're down for the count. How true this is, few realize. In a vague way, their families and friends sense that these drinkers are abnormal, but everybody hopefully awaits the day when the sufferer will rouse himself from his lethargy and assert his power of will.
So lethargy just means morbid drowsiness or this unnatural prolonged slumber or sleep.
The tragic truth is that if a man be a real alcoholic, that happy day may not arrive. He has lost control. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. This tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. Italics were the squiggly writing here, so they want us to pay attention. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable, at certain times, to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us.
Deter just means stop.
If these thoughts occur, they're hazily and readily supplanted with the threadbare idea that this time we'll handle ourselves like other people. There's a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove.
The alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, "It won't burn me this time, so here's how." Or perhaps he doesn't think at all. How often have some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant or casual way, and after the third or fourth, pounded on the bar and said to ourselves, "For God's sake, how did I ever get started again?" Only to have that thought supplanted by, "Well, I'll stop with the sixth drink," or "What's the use anyhow?" When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. These stark and ugly facts have been confirmed by legions of alcoholics throughout history. But for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop but cannot. So again, we've had 8 pages defining the problem, and eventually we get to the most wonderful sentence, there is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation.
Self-searching is our 4th step inventory. The leveling of our pride is the 5th step. The confession of shortcomings is the 5th step. And the leveling of our pride is steps 8 and 9, which the process requires.
But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it.
Step 1. So we saw that it worked in others, and we saw that we came to believe that the hopelessness and futility of life as we'd been living it was not going to work. Step 1.
When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet.
So that's the remainder of the steps. And when, therefore, we were approached by whom the problem had been solved, that's a person who worked all 12 steps.
And the kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet, as Dick said, would be the rest of the steps, steps 2 through 12. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a 4th dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed.
So that's a promise or a testimony on the part of them. There's a promise and a prayer in every instruction for every step, not just the 9th step. We tend to call the 9th step promises the promises, but there's a promise or more than one promise in every step.
The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe.
So this is a textbook. It has an asterisk there, which Mary will read.
So it goes down to say, fully explained, Appendix 2.
And so we're going to go to Appendix 2, which is on page 567
Seven
in the back of your book. And we are going to read that. That's the way you read textbooks. You go, when it gives you a reference, you go to that reference. So this was added a little bit after the book was originally written. And its title is Spiritual Experience. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself or shown up among us in many different forms. They're going to use 4 terms in this book interchangeably: spiritual experience, spiritual awakening, personality change, and psychic change. Psychic means thinking. They're going to use those 4 terms interchangeably. They mean the same thing. When I talk to some of my more religious friends, like my sister, who's a very religious person, she says, but they're different. Yes, for people in the religious community, they are slightly different. But for our purposes here, they're used interchangeably.
Let's talk about the difference between spiritual experience and spiritual awakening in that first sentence.
A spiritual experience is sudden. Boom, it happens. A spiritual awakening is something that happens very gradually. It's kind of like the difference between when I wake up in the morning, I'm awakening. And, you know, I get up, I sit up in the bed, I swing around, put my feet on the floor, I stretch, I yawn, that sort of thing. Whereas if it's a spiritual experience, it's very sudden. Boom, I'm upright and gone.
Yet it is true that our first printing, so we're talking about the first printing back in 1939, gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheaval.
So there's another word they've thrown in, is religious experience, spiritual awakening, religious experience, personality change, psychic change. Those are all used pretty interchangeably here.
And that's, of course, the whole object of doing the 12 steps, is to have one of those.
The 12 steps are a series of exercises that we perform to change our thinking.
So, happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. And, of course, we got the idea because back on page 14 in Bill's story, they talk about his great clean wind of a mountaintop blowing through. And the early members were saying, well, wait a minute, I haven't had anything like that.
The most significant person that said that was Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob's was very gradual. If you read his story in the back of the book, in the beginning of the story section, it's called Dr. Bob's Nightmare, and he will tell you that it was very gradual.
And the other thing about that is that Dr. Bob came from the Oxford groups, and one of their objectives was to pray for people to actually have a sudden spiritual experience. So here we are. We're going to go through that again. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule.
Transformations is another synonym for change.
Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration,
change,
in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. So he's starting to realize that there's a higher power, because he, in and of himself, did not have the ability to make that change in his thinking. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of a spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, so that's with a lot of force, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience,
in the light of our experience, means to work the steps the way they're laid out in the book,
can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. So they're even telling us how we can fail. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable, meaning we cannot do without these. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer.
Herbert Spencer was a 19th century social philosopher from England. There's some question as to whether Spencer actually wrote that. The quotation seems to have evolved in the course of numerous attributions to an observation written by a British theologian by the name of William Paley. But that's sort of beyond the point. The point is that he's telling us that if we close our mind, we're never going to be able to learn anything.
Mm-hmm. So now we're back to page 25. Mm-hmm. We're in that second full paragraph. I'm going to start at the beginning. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous.
So now you could read that, Mary just read it, that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives. We could read that to say that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way. I don't know which is correct, and I don't know that I've ever talked to anybody who has a real clear opinion or cause for an opinion as to which is the right way to do that.
Both of them are wonderful.
Yeah, indeed.
He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves.
To commence means to begin.
If you were as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible, and if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and the other to accept spiritual help. This we did because we honestly wanted to and were willing to make the effort.
So a bitter end is the end of a rope on a sailboat that nobody tied a knot in it so that it escapes from the block and goes overboard. It's a sailor's term. The old square riggers of the day used to have all kinds of those bitter ends.
So as we're working with a newcomer or somebody we're taking through the steps, we'll ask the question, what will you choose? Should I stay and should we continue our work here or should I go home? Sometimes we get the answer, you know what, I'm just going to tough it out. And in that case, I take my energies and start working with the next person who wants this solution.
So we're going to start reading here about a certain American businessman. The certain American businessman is Roland Hazard. He showed up on page 9 in Bill's story. He was one of the ones that showed up in court to get Ebby out of there. A certain American businessman had ability, good sense, and high character. His family was very successful. They had made textiles, I believe it was, for the First World War, for the uniforms in the First World War. Lots of people.
And blankets and such.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And they sold a lot because there were a lot of soldiers that died over there. So
he was also born with a silver spoon in his mouth, right, which is a reference to the fact that the family was very wealthy and prominent.
Right. For years, he had floundered from one sanitarium to another. He had consulted the best-known American psychiatrists. Then he had gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of the celebrated physician, the psychiatrist Dr. Jung, who prescribed for him. He actually first tried to see Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud was dying from cancer at the time and was unable to take any new patients on, which is fortunate for us, or we'd be sitting around today talking about the fact that the reason we drank is because our mothers didn't nurse us or some such nonsense. But he happened to get to Dr. Jung, who had been a protege of Freud's and had split with Freud and had a belief that a spiritual experience was necessary to overcome a number of psychiatric maladies. That's the short version. You could read about him quite a bit. There's a nice short article in our AA General Service Office Archives newsletter from the winter of 2013 about Dr. Carl Jung and how he interfaced with Alcoholics Anonymous. And you can get that from our General Service Office in New York, AA.org.
So it's my understanding that Freud really wouldn't look at any aspects of a higher power or a deity or God.
I think that's right, yes. Though experience had made him, Roland, skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. His physical and mental condition were unusually good. So when Roland Hazard went to Zurich place himself in the care of Dr. Carl Jung, he saw him every day for a year. It's fortunate that his family had a lot of money. Can you imagine seeing the preeminent psychiatrist in the world every day for a year? That's just astounding how much that must have cost him. So his physical and mental condition were unusually good. Above all, he believed he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable.
Doesn't this remind you of Bill back on page 7 where he said, surely this was the answer, self-knowledge.
Nevertheless,
and we know that that is not going to be the case.
Nevertheless, he's drunk in a short time. More baffling still, he could give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. So he returned to the doctor, whom he admired, and asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet he had no control over alcohol. Why was this? He begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless.
Utterly just means absolutely or totally.
He could never regain his position in society and would have to place himself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long. That was the great physician's opinion.
But this man still lives and is a free man. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he confined. He can go anywhere on this earth where other free men may go without disaster, providing he remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. Some of our alcoholic readers may think they can do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of the conversation our friend had with his doctor.
The doctor said, you have a mind of a chronic alcoholic. I've never seen one single case recovered where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, is there no exception? Yes, replied the doctor, there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are a phenomena. In other words, I can see them, document them, prove that they actually happen. I just don't know the cause. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements.
Look at two synonyms for change: displacement, rearrangement.
Ideas, emotions, and attitudes which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions or ideas and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement within you. With many individuals, the methods which I have employed are successful, but I've never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. The asterisk says, for amplification, see Appendix 2. Well, we've already read Appendix 2, so we won't need to go back there. You might want to do this on your own. Pause this recording now and go back there to remind yourself what we're talking about.
Upon hearing this, our friend was somewhat relieved, for he reflected that, after all, he was a good church member. This hope, however, was destroyed by the doctors telling him that while his religious convictions were very good, in his case, they did not spell the necessary vital spiritual experience.
So he's telling us, we're getting the impression here that there's a difference between a religious experience and a spiritual experience.
Here was the terrible dilemma in which our friend found himself when he had the extraordinary experience, which, as we have already told you, made him a free man. We, in our turn, sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning men. What seemed at first a flimsy reed has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us, or, if you prefer, a design for living that really works. A design for living means we can replicate it. The distinguished American psychologist William James, in his book Varieties of Religious Experience, indicates a multitude of ways in which men have discovered God.
William James was a Harvard professor of theology, and his book is basically a compilation of his lectures at Harvard. It's still in print. It's hard reading. It's hard for me. I know people who say it's very easy to read, but for me it's very hard because it's written in the language of the change between the 18th and or the 19th and 20th century. It's just hard to read, but it's still in print. You can buy it at a lot of bookstores.
I also would suggest Came to Believe, which is AA's book, and it has many short stories of how different people came to believe in a power greater than themselves.
We have no desire to convince anyone that there's only one way by which faith can be acquired. If what we have learned and felt and seen means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are children of a living Creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we're willing and able enough and honest to try. This is a powerful sentence. First of all, what they say, whatever our race, creed, or color, is an amazing. They were light years ahead of where the society was at the time. In 1939, there was de facto segregation in the South. We had legalized segregation in the armed services of the United States. A black man could not fight in the same unit as a white man. It was against the law. And we were killing Jews in Europe. So these guys are light years ahead of where society was at. And we're given a different idea in the latter half of that sentence about what we do about our relationship with our higher power. We're going to have a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we're honest and willing and honest enough to try. So we're not talking about belief. We're talking about a relationship. And a relationship is very different than knowing that something exists. Let me give you an example. I can tell you who the President of the United States is, and it doesn't make any difference which president it is. I've lived through 10 or so. It doesn't make any difference. I know his name. I know the president's name. I know his wife's name. I know his children's name. I know where he lived before he was president. I know where he vacations. I know a lot about the President of the United States, but I do not have a relationship with him. To me, the President of the United States is a two-dimensional figure. So it's very different than knowing that something exists. Same is true with our relationship with our higher power. Just knowing that there's a God or believing that there's a God is not what we're talking about here.
Those having religious affiliations will find here nothing disturbing to their beliefs or ceremonies. There is no friction among us over such matters. We think it no concern of ours what religious bodies the members identify themselves with as individuals. This should be an entirely personal affair, which each one decides for himself in the light of past associations or his present choice. Not all of us join religious bodies, but most of us favor such membership.
So that's kind of telling me that we need to stop bashing religions.
In the following chapter, there appears to be an explanation of alcoholism as we understand it. I'm sorry, there appears an explanation of alcoholism as we understand it, then a chapter addressed to the agnostic. Remember, we talked about the word agnostic meaning coming from the Latin, gnostic meaning to know. If you put an A in front of it, it means no or not. So an agnostic does not know whether there is a God or not. Many who once were in this class, meaning agnostic, are now among our members. Surprisingly enough, we find such convictions no great obstacle to a spiritual experience. Further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recover.
So much for suggestion. It's called clear-cut directions. Do we understand the difference there?
These are followed by 42 personal experiences. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God.
So that's the reason for the stories in the back of the book, that they are there so that we can hear the author in his own language and from his own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. Now, as I mentioned, our relationship's very different. Mary and I are married. If you asked me how did I establish my relationship with Mary, I can tell you in detail what we did on our first date, what we did on our second date, when we began to talk about being married, how that looked in our life, and some of the basis on which we have established our marriage relationship. I can describe that in detail. If I have a relationship with God, shouldn't I be able to do the same thing? Shouldn't I be able to tell you how I first began to understand what God meant to me? How I established that relationship. If I have one, I should be able to describe that in depth. So, my suggestion to you is that you go to your AA meetings, assuming you are going to AA meetings, and you ask, and I use the number 5, you ask 5 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, how did you establish your relationship with your higher power? If they say, I've always believed, you need to say to them, that's not what I asked you. I didn't ask you if you believed that there was a God. I asked you, how did you establish your relationship with God? And then wait for the answer. Now, I think you'll find, as I have, that there are 2 fellowships inside of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first one is the fellowship of AA. These are people who go to AA. They haven't really worked the steps with a sponsor. They're terrified of the first drink. They blow in about a minute and a half before the meeting starts, and they're out the door as soon as they said the final prayer. And these people will answer that question thusly, huh? What do you mean? Then there's the fellowship of the Spirit. These are people who have worked the 12 steps with the sponsor using this text material. They are usually showing up early at a meeting, and the conversations that you hear if you show up early go something like this. Hey, Joe, I'm working with a new man, and he's got the same kind of experiences that you've had. Can I give him your phone number so that he can call you and relate some of those experiences? We're talking about working with others in a meeting, and they're going to be the last to leave. They're usually trying to find out how they can be helpful. And those people will answer the question like this. Wow, that's really an interesting question. Thank you for asking. Here's how I developed that relationship with my higher power. So see if that's what you find as well.
Obviously, the first 100 men and women did not do this, but this is an interesting exercise to expand your work in the area of obtaining a higher power, a belief in a higher power. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing.
Chapter 3, more about alcoholism. So we're going to keep going here.
I have to laugh. Some people call this chapter more about the mind. You'll see why. Or the mind in alcoholism.
And if that's where the problem starts, that's why they have a whole chapter on it. So, chapter 3, more about alcohol. And most of us, this is the first 100 talking to us, have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. So an idea is in our heads, an obsession is in our head. This is what we're going to be looking at. The persistence of this illusion, which is in our head, is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. So here is the instructions for step one. We're on page 30, the middle of page 30. We've read 30 pages to date, plus the doctor's opinion, plus the appendices. We've read nearly 50 pages, or about 50 pages, and we're just now getting to the instructions for step one. And we're going to do a review of our first step stuff for the next several pages after this. Do you think the authors wanted us to be well-grounded in the first step? It certainly looks like that to me. There's only 100 pages that we're going to read of actual instructions for the steps. So they wanted us to be well-grounded in our first step. So here's the instructions for step one. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics.
Interesting. The word concede was defined as to acknowledge grudgingly.
And I think to fully concede is a much higher level, a much more difficult threshold to get over than admitting.
Mm-hmm.
When the steps are summarized on page 58 and 59, I believe those are the pages, they say we admit it. By the way, when it's in chapter 5, when you read how it works, that the steps are written in the past tense. We cannot take the steps in the past tense. The instructions are in the text. That's just a summary of what they did in the past. So here our instructions are to fully concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. So that can be something you can do with your sponsor. Maybe you have the privilege of being able to listen to this CD set or this recording with your sponsor. That means you can have a conversation with them. How did that look in their life? How does that look in your life? What does fully conceding mean to you? And then we'll have that conversation. They go on to say, the delusion that we're like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed.
Now, a delusion is a false belief regarding self that persists despite the facts.
And to smash something is a pretty aggressive, almost violent kind of an action. And that's what they're going to do. They're going to be very aggressive with us. They're going to go through the next several pages, giving us examples after examples of in order to smash the idea that we're like others.
We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever regains control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. So incomprehensible, it's like, I just can't understand it, and demoralization is looking it up here, to destroy the normal functioning or just throw into disorder. So everything's in an uproar. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better.
Let's just remind ourselves what we said in the very beginning of this recording sessions in our first set. That they use the male pronoun. They did not sit around and try to figure out how to irritate every woman of the 21st century. That's mm-hmm. not what they did. They wrote with the language. I know it's difficult. It was difficult for me when I was early on until I understood that they were not being mean.
That was the way they wrote right. in those days.
Even the women authors wrote that way.
We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment. which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet.
True in the 1930s, still true today in the 21st century.
Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they are in that class. By every form of self-deception, okay, self-deception is going to come from your mind, and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic.
You might have even already tried some of those.
If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people.
Those might be the heavy drinkers that was described in the previous chapter.
Mm-hmm. Here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off forever, with and without a solemn oath, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. We could increase the list ad infinitum.
That means for forever.
So it's interesting to have that discussion with the person you're working with. I know for me, I used to try to coat my stomach with pasta so that the alcohol wouldn't be observed, and then I'd have a very strict regimen that I would set out, and it would be one rum and tonic followed by a Coca-Cola followed by a rum and tonic. I can tell you I never had any Coca-Cola. We do not like to pronounce any individual as alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself.
So here's a test that you don't need to try, but it is a legitimate test.
Step over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking.
They're talking about don't step over to the bar and go and drink your brains out. They're saying controlled drinking, and here's what they mean by that.
Try to drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. It will not take long for you to decide if you are honest with yourself about it. It may be worth a bad case of jitters if you get a full knowledge of your condition. So what that would look like is I'm going to set myself up to have two, maybe three drinks and stop every night for a week. If I have the biology of an alcoholic, I'm not going to be able to stop. That craving will have set in, and I will be off to the races.
Though there's no way of proving it, we believe that early in our drinking careers, most of us could have stopped drinking. But the difficulty is that few alcoholics have enough desire to stop while there's yet time. We have heard of a few instances where people show definite signs of alcoholism were able to stop for a long period because of an overpowering desire to do so. Here's one. They're going to give us four examples here. The man of 30, the jaywalker, Jim the car guy, and Fred the accountant. So here's the first one. A man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts and quieted himself with more liquor. He was ambitious to succeed in business but saw he could get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control whatever. He made up his mind that until he had been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. An exceptional man, he remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55 after a successful and happy business career. Then he fell victim to the belief, where's a belief? In our mind, which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. Out came his carpet slippers and a bottle. In 2 months, he was in a hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital meantime. Then, gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. Every means of solving his problem, which money could buy, was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement,
meaning he had a lot of good, vigorous health and strength,
he went to pieces quickly and was dead in 4 years. This case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remain sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally.
Where does that belief come from?
In our mind. But here's a man who at 55 found he was just where he left off at 30. We have seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, or as I like to say, it's called alcoholism. It's not called alcoholism. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are in a short time as bad as ever. If we're planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, no lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol.
Immune just mean not susceptible, but we know we've got an allergy and our biology and mental situation is much different than the normal drinker.
A good conversation to have with the sponsor. Is there a lurking notion going on here?
Well, I did have a lurking notion when I was new. I sat down with my sponsor and I said, now look, I think it's really important to be a part of a wedding reception where the toasting of champagne takes place, and I need to reserve that opportunity to have a little bit of champagne when I get to that reception. And she says, Mary, do you even know anyone that's getting married, much less have you been invited to a wedding? I said, no. She says, we'll discuss it when the time comes. Luckily, I've never had to have that champagne toast.
Young people may be encouraged by this man's experience to think that they could stop, as he did, on their own willpower. We doubt if many of them can do it, because none will really want to stop. And hardly one of them, because of the peculiar mental twist already acquired, will find he can win out. Several of our crowd, that's what they used to call themselves before the book was printed. We did not have a name until 1939, and we took our name, Alcoholics Anonymous, from the title of our own book. And so they would refer to themselves as our crowd, and you will find that reference in many of the stories in the pioneer section of the stories in the back of the book. They say, I was invited to their crowd, or I told him he should come to our crowd. Several of our crowd, men of 30 or less, had been drinking only a few years, but they found themselves as helpless as those who had been drinking 20 years. To be gravely affected, one does not necessarily have to drink a long time, nor take quantities some of us have. This is particularly true of women. Potential female alcoholics often turn into the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few years. That seems to be true. Medical science doesn't, the people I've talked to anyway, don't understand why that is, but it does seem to be true even now in the 21st century. Certain drinkers who would be greatly insulted if called alcoholics are not astonished at their inability to stop. We, the first 100, who are familiar with the symptoms, see large numbers of potential alcoholics among young people everywhere, but try and get them to see it. And there's an asterisk there, and my asterisk says, true, when this book was first printed, published, but in 1992, U.S. and Canada membership survey showed about one-fifth of AAs were 30 and under.
And again, an asterisk might be, I have one for 2011, and it would be 13%.
Yeah.
As we look back, we feel we had gone on drinking many years beyond the point where we could quit on our own willpower. If anyone questions whether he has entered this dangerous area, let him try leaving liquor alone for a year. There you go. There's a second test. We've had to step over to the bar room and try some controlled drinking. Now we've got another test. Try leaving it alone for a year. If he is a real alcoholic and very far advanced, there is scant chance of success. In the early days of our drinking, we occasionally remain sober for a year or more, becoming serious drinkers again later. Though you may be able to stop for a considerable period, you may yet be a potential alcoholic.
And here's the, I believe, the best test.
We think few to whom this book will appeal can stay dry anything like a year.
So this book appeals to me. It talks to me. But I show it to my brother or sister, and they don't get it. They're not alcoholic. So the fact that it appeals to me might be a test for whether I'm alcoholic or not.
Some will be drunk the day after making their resolutions, most of them within a few weeks. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop.
So do you want to stop?
Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever. Yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. This utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. How then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So, we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux or focal point of the problem.
The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind.
What sort of thinking from the mind dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking?
So here's our second story. Here's what I call Jim the car guy.
So this is our accidental getting drunk story. Our first example is a friend, accidental in quotes, by the way. Our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative, meaning profitable, automobile agency.
That's what we would call a car dealership today.
He had a commendable World War record,
and of course,
meaning he was very praised for his World War service.
And that's World War I, of course.
He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He is an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition.
I was raised in this period of time, and I think what they mean by nervous disposition is what today we would call a stutterer. My brother was stuttered, and they refer to that as a nervous disposition. So I think that's what they mean by nervous disposition.
He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. We told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer we had found. So what they told him they knew about alcoholism came from Dr. Silkworth.
And the answer was the 12 steps as they knew them then.
He made a beginning. So in other words, he didn't take all of the steps. His family was reassembled, and he began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life.
Uh-oh, warning, warning, warning. If this was a PowerPoint presentation, we'd be flashing that on the screen in big red letters. He failed to enlarge his spiritual life. What does that mean? He did not work all 12 steps. He worked only part of them because it says he made a beginning. Exactly where he left off, we don't know, but we know he didn't, and we are told later on in the book that we have to do work and self-sacrifice for others in order to enlarge our spiritual life. So that's what he didn't do.
To his consternation or dismay, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic and in serious condition. That's step one. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family, for whom he had a deep affection.
All really good reasons to not drink.
Yet, he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story. I came to work on Tuesday morning.
So there are people, my friend Charlie Parmalee, who used to do a number of big book studies around the country, used to say, I wonder what happened to Monday. It may just be he had Monday off, who knows, but nonetheless.
I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned.
So this, we're going to find out as we get to the step four instructions that resentments have the power to kill. And this, he's in dangerous territory. I felt irritated, that's a synonym for a resentment. He's in big trouble. He's got a resentment, let's see what he does about it.
I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious.
Now, wait a minute. It is serious. He has a resentment, and he's got an argument with his boss. It's serious. He's discounting it. He's minimizing it.
Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car.
Oh, there's a good thing for an alcoholic with a resentment who just had an argument with his boss is to go drive in the country. That's really a smart thing to do. What he should have done is picked up the phone and called his sponsor.
And it's interesting, don't they have offices for people?
We'll talk about that.
Okay. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar.
Now, what are you stopping there for? Come on, he's by himself. It's not like,
I had no intention of drinking.
Bull, that's all he's thinking about.
I just thought I would get a sandwich. So his wonderful keen mind is now giving him these ideas. I also had the notion, coming from my mind, that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I had been going to it for years.
Now, I know a lot of people in the car business. And never, I don't know one single car guy who has ever, ever sold a car in a bar. That's why the car dealership gives him a desk, a telephone, and the admin assistants help in the background so that he can sell them in there and he doesn't need to go to the bar to try to fuss. I don't know, maybe you know somebody who sold a car at a bar. I sure don't. And that's just rationalizing.
I had eaten there many times during the month I was sober.
Why are you going to a bar for lunch by yourself when you're newly sober?
I sat down at a table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking.
It certainly has. He's thought that's all he's been thinking about is how to have a drink. He's in a bar.
I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk.
Hey, so have you ever gone to a restaurant and ordered two complete separate lunches? Order one, eat it, and then order another one. Why is he doing that? He's looking for an excuse to drink. He hasn't thought of it yet, so he's got to have a second lunch.
Suddenly.
Not so sudden. He's been thinking about it since he had that argument with his boss.
The thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach.
Well, aside from having really bad taste, he's now giving in to the obsession.
I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach.
Yeah, he's had two lunches.
The experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk.
I don't know any non-alcoholics who experiment with alcohol. They may decide to have a red wine tonight instead of a white wine and see how that whether they enjoy that or not, but they're not experimenting with alcohol.
That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another.
Yeah.
Now the phenomenon of craving has been
right.
set up.
Right, it happens. He tries another one, now he's got the phenomenon of craving. He's going to drink until one of those three things happens.
Thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim.
So fortunately, Jim is put into a place where he's separated, physically separated from alcohol.
Here was the threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of that intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity.
So we are not using the word insane or insanity in this book in a legal or clinical manner. It's not the precise definition. We are using the word insanity as only the way we react, the alcoholic reacts to alcohol.
How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? You may think this is an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that, parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial or insignificant excuse for taking the first drink.
So old Jim, he says, well, I can take a drink if I mix it with milk. That's pretty trivial.
Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day, we would ask ourselves in all earnestness or seriousness and sincerity how it could have happened.
So now they're going to do the deliberate drunk here.
In some circumstances, we've gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified by nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like.
I'll show her.
But even in this type of beginning, we are obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient in light of what always happened. We now see that when we began to drink deliberately instead of casually, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences might be. So the premeditation is that planning stage. Our behavior is as absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as that of an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. He gets a thrill out of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles. He enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings. Up to this point, you would label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun.
Queer in the 1930s meant odd.
Luck then deserts him, and he is slightly injured several times in succession. You would expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out.
How many times did people say that to me? Dick, why don't you just cut it out?
Presently, he is hit again, and this time has a fractured skull. Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car, or streetcar, breaks his arm. He tells you he has decided to stop jaywalking for good, but in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. On through the years, this conduct continues, accompanied by his continual promises to be careful or to keep off the streets altogether. Finally, he can no longer work, his wife gets a divorce, and he is held up to ridicule. He tries every known means to get the jaywalking idea out of his head. He shuts himself up in an asylum, hoping to mend his ways, but the day he comes out, he races in front of a fire engine, which breaks his back. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he?
You may think our illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer, there's a reference here to a ringer washers of the day in the 1930s. Washing machines had a tub in the, that agitated the clothes, and then they didn't have spin dry yet, so you would take the clothes and run them through a double roller arrangement that would squeeze the water out of them so you could take them out on the line and hang them on the clothesline. Those of us that we who have been through the ringer have to admit, if we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects where alcohol has been involved, we have been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? Some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply. We admit we have some of the symptoms, but we've not gone to the extremes you fellows did, nor are we likely to, for we understand ourselves so well after what you've told us that such things cannot happen again. We have not lost everything in life through drinking, and we certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information. That may be true of certain non-alcoholic people who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at the present time, are able to stop or moderate because their brains and bodies have not been damaged as ours were. But the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is a point we wish to emphasize and re-emphasize, to smash home on our alcoholic readers as it has been revealed to us out of bitter experience. Let us take another illustration. Fred's a partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He has a fine home, is happily married, and the father of promising children of college age. He has so attractive a personality, he makes friends with everyone. If ever there was a successful businessman, it's Fred. To all appearances, he is a stable, well-balanced individual. Yet he's alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves. The doctor intimated or hinted strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so in spite of his character and standing. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem. We told him what we knew of alcoholism. He was interested and conceded that he had some of the symptoms, but he was a long way from admitting he could do nothing about it himself. He was positive that his humiliating experience plus the knowledge he had acquired would keep him sober for the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. So Fred's solution is to know what he needs and to keep on guard.
We heard no more of Fred for a while. One day we were told that he was back in the hospital. This time he was quite shaky. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us. The story he told is most instructive, for here was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all his other concerns, yet was flat on his back nevertheless. Let him tell you about it. I was much impressed with what you fellows said about alcoholism, and I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink, but I was confident it could not happen to me after what I had learned.
Learned is self-knowledge.
I reasoned I was not so far advanced as most of you fellows, that I had been usually successful in licking my other personal problems, and that I would therefore be successful where you men failed. I felt I had every right to be self-confident, that it would be only a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard.
So Fred's solution to his drinking is to exercise his willpower and to keep on guard. So that's what he's telling us. So okay. Let's see how that works.
In this frame of mind, I went about my business, and for a time, all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks and began to wonder if I had not been making too hard work of a simple matter.
So much for keeping on guard. He's already dropping his guard. I'm making too big a deal out of this. I don't need to worry quite so much about it. Half of his solution is going away.
One day I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I had been out of town before during this particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about that. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased and knew my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. I went to my hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to my mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all, nothing more. I ordered a cocktail in my meal.
So his other solution now, his other half of his solution is exercising his willpower. That's gone away now.
I ordered a cocktail and my meal. Then I ordered another cocktail. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me a highball would be fine before going to bed. So I stepped into the bar and had one.
So you see, I had a couple of drinks with my dinner, and then I went out and I got some physical exercise, and now I shouldn't have to worry about this. I'm really making way too big a deal out of this. Let's see how that worked out for him.
I remember having several more that night and plenty next morning. I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York and of finding a friendly taxicab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. The driver escorted me about for several days. I know little of where I went or what I said and did. Then came the hospital with unbearable mental and physical suffering.
So his solution of exercising his willpower and staying on guard didn't work real well for him.
As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesized or made a prediction that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more, for what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. Two of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to see me.
This is called an old-fashioned 12-step call.
They grinned, which I didn't like so much, and then asked me if I thought myself alcoholic and if I were really licked this time.
So they're asking him about step one.
I had to concede both propositions.
Now, look what they do.
They piled on me heaps of evidence to the effect that an alcoholic mentality, such as I had exhibited in Washington, was a hopeless condition. They cited cases out of their own experience by the dozen.
So that's exactly what they're doing in this book. They're trying to smash the idea that we are like other people. That's what they're just piling on. Once he's admitted he's alcoholic, they're piling on that. Heaps of evidence.
This process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. Then they outlined the spiritual answer and program of action, which 100 of them had followed successfully.
The 12 steps.
Though I had been only a nominal churchman, their proposals were not, intellectually, hard to swallow. But the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. It meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out of the window. That was not easy, but the moment I made up my mind to go through with the process, I had the curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems.
All my problems, not all my medical conditions.
I have since been brought into a way of living infinitely more satisfying and I hope more useful than the life I lived before. My old manner of life was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back to it even if I could. Fred's story speaks for itself. We hope it strikes home to thousands like him. He had felt only the first nip of the ringer.
So if you're putting your clothes through those double roller arrangements at the top of the ringer and you didn't get your hand out of the way before it kind of got to the end of the ringer, it would pinch the end of your fingers, and it's called a nip of the ringer.
Otherwise, if your whole hand went through, it got mangled. So he's pretty much saying I'm a bit of what we might call today a high-bottom drunk. Mm-hmm. Most alcoholics have to be pretty badly mangled before they really commence to solve their problem. Many doctors and psychiatrists agree with our conclusions. One of these men, staff member of a world-renowned hospital.
So this staff member is Dr. Percy Pollack, who is a psychiatrist, and the hospital is Bellevue Hospital in New York City.
Recently made this statement to some of us. What you say about the general hopelessness of the average alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As to two of you men, whose stories I have heard.
He's talking about Bill Wilson, our co-founder in New York, and Hank Parkhurst, who is the author of Two Employers in Chapter 10 in the front of the book.
There is no doubt in my mind that you were 100% hopeless, apart from divine help. Had you offered yourselves as patients at this hospital, I would not have taken you if I had been able to avoid it. People like you are too heartbreaking. Though not a religious person, I have profound respect for the spiritual approach in such cases as yours. For most cases, there is virtually no other solution.
As my high school teachers and college teachers used to say, okay, now we're going to review this. They say, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. So thank you. We'll move on now to chapter 4.